Today's Dharma talk will be about to what extent do we believe in karma? I'm sure this is going to be a very interesting topic. In fact, it's a bit of a paradox because in Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha talked about four things that one should not conjecture or think about. And what are these four things? The first one is Buddha Visayo Achinteyo. The range or the province of a Buddha is not to be thought about. Anyone who tries to do so will end up being distraught and probably go crazy to some extent. And the second is Jhana Visayo. Jhana Visayo is the range of jhana, which is actually a subject of very hot controversy nowadays. People talk about their different interpretations of jhana. Some people say that when you are in jhana, you are totally absorbed and you are oblivious of what's happening in your five senses. Some others say that no, when you are in jhana, you are aware of the five senses. It's just that you don't have any desire for any of the pleasures of the five senses. So these are all about the range of jhana as well. If you think too much about it, then you might go crazy. Okay, then the next one is Kama Vipako Achinteyo. The result of karma is also not to be thought about. And finally, Loka Chinta Achinteya. Thinking about the origins of the world is also not productive. If you think too much, you also go crazy. Whether you think about the black hole or any other theories of how this world came into existence, doesn't matter because we don't really know. How far back in the past can we investigate? And where is there actually a beginning in a circle? So anyway, it's a paradox because although the Buddha says that we should not think about all these things, in many suttas he talked about karma and he talked about the results of karma. In many suttas, he gave very, very graphic descriptions of the jhana experience and he encouraged monks to practice jhana. Actually, the word he uses, Kama Vipako Achinteyo. Chinteyo means not to be thought of. But he's been talking about it, so that gives us a lot of food for thought. As I was coming back from my morning walk this morning, I overheard Raymond and Brother Chong Lin talking about this boy whose body was discovered in the jetty in Klang. They were speculating on what actually happened. Well, when you really cannot find the real cause, then Buddhists would say, well, it is karma la. Right or not? Is that wrong? Is that true? To what extent do we surrender and say, that's karma? I'll give you another interesting story that happened in Taiping a couple of months ago. There's one lawyer in Taiping who was at the peak of his career. Maybe he's in his late 40s or early 50s. Was quite a charitable person and he helped a lot in the fundraising. In fact, spearheaded the fundraising of his alma mater, his school, and collected quite a large sum of money for the renovation and improvement of the facilities in his old school. He's also known to be a boozer. He drinks quite a lot. So one evening, he and some of our Buddhist friends were attending a wedding dinner in a hotel nearby. It's called Flemington Hotel, right? It's near Lake Gardens. They were having some dinner there. And in the course of the dinner, you know, he felt very sleepy, he was nodding away. And he didn't really drink too much, not his usual amount. One of his friends says, okay, come, let's go back, I think you're really tired. He says, okay, never mind, it's okay, I'll just hang on for a while. So after that, he hung on for a while. Then he got up, apparently to go to the toilet. And that was the last they heard of him. They couldn't find him. Looked high and low, all over the place, couldn't find him. So of course the family and the parents were very concerned. Is this a case of kidnap? If it was a case of kidnapping, how come there were no news at all from the kidnappers? So one day, 2 days passed, and still no news. They scouted around the place, tried to look for any signs, couldn't find anything at all. Somebody said that a couple of days ago, they had taken a photograph of a little bridge across a little stream that was behind the hotel. And when they shot the picture, it turned out in the camera that there was a sort of a ghostly figure hovering above the little pond just at the side of the bridge. And Chinese superstition said that place is dirty. When the mother heard about this, the mother, being a Taoist, she went to the bridge and started to pray and made a request to the spirits there, at least show her the body. And after she did that, after she prayed to the spirits there, the next day, the body floated up. He actually drowned, apparently, in the little pool of water, which is just about less than 2 feet. And how could that happen? When his body floated up, he was all bloated up, very ugly, like one of those tsunami victims. And I think part of his arm was already gnawed or eaten up by monitor lizard, biawak. But they found that his pants was unzipped, so probably he was trying to urinate, and maybe in his drunkenness he just fell, and then he hit something, some rocks down there, because they found that his skull was damaged, his forehead was damaged, and then because he sort of fainted, then he drowned in the water. So was this foul play, or was this his karma? Now to digress a bit, so some of our Buddhist friends, they attended the wake and they talked to the children who were still quite young, still schooling, and advised the children, hey, you talk to your daddy, tell daddy, don't worry about us, mom can take care of us, you just go your way and just let go. Don't be concerned about us, we can take care of ourselves. Now this guy is a Taoist, whereas the wife is a Christian. The wife couldn't understand why our Buddhist friends would ask her children to tell her father to take it easy. She said it's unfair that he should leave the children to me to take care of them. So actually it's a very selfish thing, isn't it, on the part of the wife. She doesn't want the late husband to take it easy because now she's got all the burden of taking care of the kids. So what does this suggest? It suggests that she also wants him to suffer because she is suffering. Is that real love? Or is it just selfishness? But anyway, this is just digression. So, to what extent do we believe karma? There's one particular sutta in the Sanghita Nikaya, Sivaka Sutta, whereby someone came to ask the Buddha. He said that there are some samanas and brahmanas, recluses and philosophers, who preach that whatever we experience is entirely the result of past karma. In Pali, this is called Pubbakata Hetu Ditti. It's a view that whatever we experience is the result of past karma. Is this true? If that is so, then it would be very fatalistic, right? If whatever we experience is entirely the result of past karma, then what can we do in order to save ourselves or to overcome those karmic obstructions? Of course, the Buddha refuted that. Then again, in a particular sutta, he talks about old and new karma. He says, monks, I will tell you old and new karma. What is old karma and what is new karma? Then he says, monks, the eye is old karma, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is old karma. And what is new karma? Whatever that one does to body, speech and mind, that is new karma. Okay, let's analyze this a bit. If you look at it from the Abhidhamma point of view, the Abhidhamma says that all our senses, the five senses, the five sense organs, plus the mind organ, these are all vipakas. resultants, karma resultants. So if you are born blind, your eye is defective and is a result of past karma. The Abhidhamma goes on further to in detail to say that whatever you experience through the five sense doors is a result of past karma. Experience involves the sense organ, the sense object, and the sense consciousness. When these three things come together, that's called contact. In Pali, it's called passa. Contact is the confluence of these three things: the sense organ, the sense object, and the sense consciousness. This includes the mind organ as well, which means the mind organ, mind object, and mind consciousness. Mind, in this context, is called mano in Pali. So we have mano, dhamma, and mano-vijnana. Mano is the mind organ, dhamma is mental objects, and mano-vijnana is mind consciousness. So experience involves these three things coming together. The Abhidhamma says that all experiences of five sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and sensing with your body, is a result of past karma. Now this sounds like it's a wrong view, isn't it? The Buddha refuted. The Buddha says that it's wrong to say that whatever you experience is entirely the result of that past karma. Now this is something very subtle. From what I read in our suttas, this is the main difference between the Jains and the Buddhists. Although both believe in the law of karma, both believe in the workings of karma. And the Jains believe that everything that we experience is a result of past karma, and you have to endure all this pain in order to exhaust your past karma. So the subtle difference here is that the Abhidhamma talks about the five senses. Experiences through the five senses are all results of the past karma, whereas the sixth sense door, which is the mind, that is not necessarily the result of past karma. It is both the result of past karma as well as present karma itself. Okay, let's look at this more closely. Which means to say that whatever that we can sense through our five senses, whenever you see, hear, smell, taste, or feel something with your body, it is the result of your past karma. And of course, our past karma is so variegated. We have done such a wide variety of karma in the past that we go through ups and downs in life. Life is never smooth being a human being. There are times when you have nice experiences, pleasurable experiences, and there are times when you have unpleasant experiences, times when you have neutral experiences. Now, in terms of feelings, according to the Abhidhamma, whatever that can be experienced through the four senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, and tasting, is accompanied by just upekkha, neutral feeling. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But what can be experienced through the body is either pleasant or unpleasant, either sukha or dukkha. Okay, this is talking about the five senses. When you talk about the sixth sense, it can be any of the three types of feelings. It can be neutral feeling, it can be pleasant feeling, it can be unpleasant feeling. So whatever that we can experience through our first four senses are actually all neutral in character, neutral in feeling. But it is the mind that interprets the experience. It's the mind that puts meaning into the experience, and the mind that creates within itself the feeling of pleasure or displeasure. That's why it's so important to be able to understand how the mind works, to practice in order to become a master of the mind rather than becoming a slave of one's defilements that are associated with the mind. Okay, we talked about past karma, and we also talked about the Buddha saying that the six sense organs are all past karma. And then he says, what is present karma? Present karma is what we think, speak, and do, right, through our three doors of action. And that constitutes present karma. Now, although we speak and we act through the body, all these actions and speech and even our thoughts are motivated by the mind, isn't it? So this very, very intricate relationship of experiences with the five senses and the mind sense will constitute the quality of our life. On the one hand, whatever that you can experience through your five senses is the result of past karma. But how you react to them is your present karma that you're creating, which will influence your future as the past karma. Right? We have to understand this very carefully. So, we should understand that because there's still an element of choice in our actions, we are not fatalistic in our outlook on life. Although we can accept the fact that whatever we experience through our five senses is a result of past karma, we can still attempt to modify the result of the past karma. For example, you are suddenly diagnosed with having cancer. Of course, you're not going to just surrender and say, oh, that's the result of my past karma and not do anything about it, right? Now, you will try to explore various ways of trying to cure that cancer, either through conventional mainstream medication and treatment or otherwise. Okay, there's also another sutta which talks about other causes and conditions that bring about experience besides just karma. This is actually a reply to Sivika, which I talked about earlier, Sivika Sutta, where the Sivika came to ask the Buddha whether it is true that whatever we experience is a result of past karma. And I did say that the Buddha rejected this idea. And he said that actually there are eight causes of our experience. The first three are related to the humors in our body and to the popular belief and understanding in the Buddhist time that whatever ailments or whatever sensations that we feel in the body is a result of how the humors in our body are formed. The humors in the body, according to the Ayurvedic belief at that time, is based on bile, based on wind, and based on what they call phlegm, these three things. So if there is certain experiences might be caused by excessive bile or insufficient bile secretion, some experiences are caused by insufficient or excessive phlegm or by winds within the body. And so this is somehow quite related to our Chinese traditional medical approach, which talks about heatiness and coolness and too much wind in your stomach and in your body and so forth, right? Something like that. But it's a concept which has been used by people at the time very quite effectively in the treatment of ailments. The fourth one is a combination of these three. It could be a combination of your bile, the phlegm, and the winds that are not properly balanced. This could also be a cause of it. Then the fifth one is about weather. When you are staying in this aircon room, you feel nice and comfortable. Right? You go out into the sun, then you feel very hot and you sweat a lot. Okay, so this is nothing to do with karma, not past karma, but it's actually because of weather conditions. And sixth cause for your experiences is called visama parihajana, which means unbalanced way of taking care of your body. Because if you're not selective of your food, you just eat a lot of high cholesterol stuff or very fatty things, you're not choosy, you follow your tongue rather than follow the needs of your body, right? Then you can get into trouble. That's diet. Lifestyle also, if you just sit in front of the computer the whole day, you don't do enough exercise, that will also affect your sensations in your body, your health. And the seventh is due to upakamika. Upakamika means through external effort. Somebody causes some unpleasant experiences to happen to you because of somebody else's exertion or interference, external interference. And the last one is because of karma. Okay, so according to this sutta, the Buddha talks about all these eight various types of things that can cause pleasant or unpleasant experiences. The last one of which is karma. The first three is the humors in the body, bile, phlegm, or wind. And the fourth is a combination of these three. The fifth is weather. The sixth is your own lifestyle, diet and lifestyle. And number seven is through external interference. And finally, the last one is because of karma. So what the Buddha is trying to say is that karma is not the only cause of the experiences that we encounter in the course of our lifetime. And there are many other causes as well. But I also like to ask further, if there's imbalance in the body due to too much pitta, too much bile, excessive bile, according to Ayurveda medicine, that excessive bile will lead to mental disorder. So if there's an excessive bile leading to mental disorder, why is it that that particular person's body produces so much bile? Why is that person's hormones out of balance, such that he becomes schizophrenic? Why is it not like any other normal person? Why is it that some people have so much bile that they produce psychosomatic diseases? And so forth. This is also questionable. Why? So in the end, you could say it's also because of karma, isn't it? It is the karma that will influence the production of your hormones and whatever things that are secreted in your body, because you have no conscious control over that. Of course, there is also some connection with your diet and your lifestyle. Let's say everybody is having the same, takes good care of their body. All do exercise, all do qigong, all do yoga, all eat organic food. Yet among these people, there will be differences. Yeah, in their body systems. This story, this Ajahn Brahm story, talks about this couple who found out one day that they were born in heaven, and then they were having such a nice time in heaven. I don't know how many, 20 whole golf course, and everything was so wonderful up in heaven. And then this husband complained to the wife and said, "You asked me to eat organic food and all those stuff, it took me longer to get here. We should have died earlier and come up to heaven earlier and enjoy all this stuff rather than suffer down on earth." I can tell you one particular supporter or devotee of us from Taiping, who is a staunch meditator, very highly advanced in the jhana practice in the Pao tradition. She was also formerly from the Mahasi tradition, but later on she found that it was more fulfilling for her to practice high states of jhana. And she was also a very dedicated Dharma worker. She would go all the way to Burma to help out in the Pao Center, and whenever there are any retreats in Malaysia, she would be around helping if she was not on retreat herself. And she was also a very health-conscious person. She would eat organic food, she would do coffee enema and so forth, and invite Achans from Thailand to conduct all these health courses. Well, finally, she died of cancer. I think cervical cancer. In her last moments, the husband was still trying to coach her to maintain her mindfulness. So a person who does not understand the complexity of karma would question, how come she is such a saintly person, so generous and then so well developed in terms of bhavana, in terms of meditative cultivation, and yet she has to die such a horrible death? There's also this couple of other very highly developed people, like Swami Rama, the founder of the Himalayan Institute in the US, and also Krishnamurti, who also died of cancer. And they also said also died of cancer, right? And meditation teachers who die of cancer and tumor. That's why the Buddha said, don't think about the result of karma, because it's so complex that we don't really understand which karma that we did in the past will bear fruit at any time. Yeah, only the Buddha, the omniscient one, would be able to identify which particular karma would give result at any particular time. That's not part of our livelihood, to look into your fortune regarding your karma. Although there are fortune tellers around, they can do that from other teachings, which are not Buddhist teachings. This is an interesting sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha talks about karma. What is karma? The cause by which karma comes into play, the diversity in karma, the result of karma, the cessation of karma, and the path of practice for the cessation of karma. So this is important. This is a book of six, so there are 6 points altogether. And the first one is, what is karma? I'm sure that all of you have heard this very often. The Buddha says in several suttas, Jitanahang bhikkhave kammang vadami. Monks, I say that karma is volition. Volition is the intention in your mind that motivates a particular course of action, whether it is mental, verbal, or physical, or bodily. If we understand this, then this can save us from a lot of unnecessary worry and regret. Sometimes things happen, but we did not have any intention. It was unintentional. You step on an ant and you kill an ant. You close the door and you squash a gecko between the door. But you don't have to feel remorseful about that because it was not intentional. Okay? So even if you did something out of good intention and then something turned out for the worse, then you should also not blame yourself. You did it out of good intention. But it turned out that way, well, perhaps you could say, well, it's the karma of the person. For example, this is an interesting story. There's one of our devotees in Taiping. The mother has a long history of struggling with the family. Her only son is a schizo. And this schizophrenia started only maybe in his early 20s when he was in college. He was doing quite well in school, and then when he was in college, this thing happened. And it's been dragging on for years and years and years. But he's not only totally schizophrenic in the psychiatric sense of the word, he's also got some spiritual interference from spirits and devas and things like that. He's like living in the twilight zone. He cannot differentiate between the reality of our physical world and the reality of the other world, because he can communicate with the spirits in the other world, and yet he's in this world, so sometimes it's like a conflict. It's not knowing which is the real thing. It's just like when you're in a dream, you know, and you know that you're dreaming, but is that really real? Or when you get up and then you see yourself, and then is this real or is this a dream? This is a complicated issue. Anyway, she has lived with this person for many years now. I think maybe 15 or 20 years now. And on top of that, she got two other daughters, and the daughter also got married, and then there was broken up marriage. Marriage was not a successful one. And then the other daughter, the youngest daughter, was single, and then she got involved in the Dhamma, very intensely involved with the Dhamma, was a meditator, resigned, going in and out of meditation retreats, and then going to India for pilgrimage, coming back, wanting to become a nun. And at first, of course, she received some resistance from the family. The sister is actually supporting the mother as well as her own child, her own children. And the mother is not really working. And she was also supporting the mother. This dynamics going on in the family. You know, of course, the other sister says, if you go off like that, and then I have to support my children as well as mom. Yeah. So what happens if something happens to her? So these dynamics were there, and she was torn between wanting to renounce and staying on and not being able to stay on because she's already got disgusted and bored with the world. And then one day, the mother was working as a part-time cook in a charitable organization, came and was introduced to a guy who was supposed to be a medium, a young man actually, very young man. And he sort of said that he could help the son. And so out of love for the son, the mother brought that medium to the house to try to cure her son of that schizophrenia come spirit involvement sort of stuff. And then somehow this guy got attracted to the youngest daughter. And he is being a medium and delving in all this sort of stuff. He sort of charmed her. And she was actually charmed by him and then absconded with him. All the plans of becoming a nun all finished. And then went to stay with him and ended up selling balloons. Very sad story. And then the mother was very, very distraught and then requested us to help her. So we brought her, we did a lot of chanting for her, trying to release her from that charm and so forth. Well, it didn't work. It didn't work. And this also has to do with her pent-up feelings towards the family for not wanting to release her to become a nun. Very complicated stuff. So in the end, she ran away, ran off, and went even to register. And then the mother went and made a police report. This stuff going on. And then finally, she had a way. She said, I'm over 21, I'm an adult, you got no right to object to what I want to do. And that's basically what's eating her, because all the time they have been objecting to her wanting to do what she wants, but now she's doing something which the mother doesn't have a right to object to. So finally, she went off. And then the mother was so remorseful. Said, it's my fault for bringing that guy into the house. If I had not brought that guy to the house, this would not have happened. But I said, that's not your fault. You were doing it out of good intentions for your son, right? And it turned out that way. And then your whole family is a lot of dukkha. I really admire you being able to go through all this for so many years and you're still alive. And you're still sane and alive, and she still comes to do dana whatever she can. And she's really a very admirable person. Before that, her husband was suffering from kidney failure for many years, and she has to take care of the husband, take him to dialysis every twice or three times a week, all the way to Ipoh. And then going to take care of this half-crazy son. And then two daughters are also having problems with their life. So I told her, in such times, we have to fall back on karma, isn't it? What else can we say? It's not you. These things are all very intricately intertwined. You and your children, you and the people that you associate with, all have karmic links before in the past. You're here because of your karmic links. Now, some of them, they are debts that you have to pay. Then, might as well pay it with dignity and gracefully. This is where faith comes in. Although people like to say that, Buddhism does not rely on blind faith. But actually, for me, I think that belief in karma is also something like blind faith, isn't it? When we cannot find any more explanations, we always say, it's a karma lah, what to do? What's the difference when you compare to the Muslims and the Christians? It's Allah's will. It's God's will. I just surrender. Never mind. It helps, doesn't it? But it can be even more profound, your faith can be even more stable and strong if you can also see this law of cause and conditioning, cause and effect in your daily life. Okay, to give you an example of one of our yogis. She's been a long time yogi also, and she practices a lot of daily awareness. Always watching her mind the whole day to see how the mind works in relation to the senses. And she's also a very good friend of this lawyer who drowned, unfortunately. And she said when she went to the wake and when she saw the corpse of the lawyer, she could not cry. Everybody else was crying. The family members, the friends, all were teary looking at such a bloated corpse. And also the circumstances under which your children and the family is left in. She said she couldn't cry and she felt a bit uncomfortable. Everybody was crying, but she was not crying. So she had to wear dark glasses just to pretend that she's crying. I asked her, why can't you cry? She said, well, we all will be watching the mind all the time. We know that these are all cause and conditioning. There's nothing that we can do about it. Why cry over spilt milk? And it becomes a part of you, you know. Why do people cry? People cry because their expectations are not met. Right or not? Yeah, because they're clinging to something. That is the cause of sorrow. When the Buddha defined, one of the definitions of dukkha is not getting what you want, being separated from what you love. So it's all due to attachment. But if you're watching your mind all the time, the whole day, not only once in a while, once a year for a 1 week retreat, but you're watching the mind the whole day, you can understand how the mind works. You can understand most of our mental sufferings are caused by our unskillful ways of reacting to our senses, including our minds. Okay, let me get back to this sutta before I close and open to question and answer. So the Buddha here says that there are these six things. One is karma and the cause by which karma comes into play. Thirdly, the diversity in karma. And fourthly, the result of karma. Fifth, the cessation of karma and the path of practice that leads to the cessation of karma. Of course, the first one is karma is intention. The second is the cause by which karma comes into play. Okay, what is the cause by which karma comes into play? Anyone wants to try?
If there's some bad karma that's sort of ready to ripen, and if that person's behavior or his lifestyle at that time is conducive to that bad karma to ripen, then it can ripen.
Okay, good. At least someone tried. Anyone else? Driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay. Anyone else?
I think it's all going back to our thought.
All right. Thanks. Okay, so we got three answers. The lifestyle of a person that conduces to bad karma ripening. The second one says it's greed, hatred, and delusion. The third one says that it's thought itself. Let's see what the Buddha says. The Buddha gives a very simple answer. He says, contact. Contact is the cause and condition for karma to arise. Contact is the most basic of all things. Remember what contact is? Contact is the confluence of your sense organ, the sense object, and the sense consciousness. Because of contact, only will there be karma. Because of contact, only will you be aware of what's happening. And when you're aware of what's happening, then you'll react to it. Isn't it? So this is a very basic cause. If there was no contact, then you wouldn't know anything. Right? Once you don't perceive anything, what karma is there to create? Okay, so this is the answer to that. Then the diversity in karma should be known. Different types of karma. If you learn Abhidhamma, you will know there are actually 4 times 4, 16 types of karma. But that Abhidhamma was composed much later on. These are the words of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, there is karma to be experienced in hell, karma to be experienced in the realm of the common animals, karma to be experienced in the realm of ghosts, karma to be experienced in the human world, karma to be experienced in the world of the devas. This is called the diversity of karma. Now the devas here include both the sense sphere devas as well as the brahmas. So when the Buddha talked about the diversity of karma, he's talking about karma, the result of which are to be experienced in different realms of existence. The result of karma should be known. Now, what is meant by the result of karma? Just now we've talked about experiencing karma in different realms, right? Here he talks about the result of karma should be known, and he says there is 3 categories. One is the result of karma that bears fruit in this very life. The second one is in the next life, and the third one is in lives after that next life. How does this work? As you see, the Buddha says that karma is intention. But the mind changes so quickly. And the mind works so fast. When you say intention, for example, you say, I want to do dana today. Yesterday you had this thought. There's only one thought, you know. That's an intention. But then, besides that intention, you still need to have the intention to go shopping. The intention to figure out what you want to cook. Many intentions involved. Why to cook, how you want to cook, what time you want to cook, when you will go, who you will bring along. Millions and millions of intentions, right? And each one of them is karma. Right? And each one of them can give result. So you can imagine, how can we compute how much karma we have done in the past? How can we compute which karma will give rise to which result at any particular point of time? It's so complicated. So complicated. But the Abhidhamma try to simplify things. It's just like when we, in primary school, we study about geography, right? We talk about how the rain comes, and how water is evaporated from the seas and the rivers, it goes to the sky, and then clouds are formed, and then winds blow, the clouds come over, and then it hit the mountain, and then it rains. Yeah, that's how we are taught the very basic principles of weather and how weather forms. But of course, no weatherman can actually predict it that simply. It's a very, very simplified form to understand how weather works. So in the same way, the Abhidhammikas also at least give us some sort of basic understanding of how this happens. How is it that one karma can create so many results? And then they postulate that in the mind door, when a particular mental process happens, it happens for 17 mind moments. And out of the 17 mind moments, the first 10 or so, they are a combination of resultants, no karma involved. Only the last 7, there's karma involved. The last 7 mind moments are 7 moments of intention. The first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. The first moment of intention will give rise to a result in this very life. And then the last one, number 7, will give result in the next life as a rebirth consciousness. And the middle ones, from 2 to 6, they will follow you until you attain Nibbana. So you know you have a whole jing gang of all this karma following you, waiting for the right moment to ripen. And the first one is not so powerful, so it will only give rise in this very life. The last one, because it's a culmination of 7 dot moments, is the most powerful one, and it will give rebirth consciousness. And rebirth consciousness, you may think that it's only just one moment, but no. That karma will sustain you for the rest of your life. For your whole lifetime, it is a karma that is making sure that your organs are working properly. If your karma expires, gone, finished. You cannot survive anymore. So that's the result of us karma and all these organs in our body. So we have these 3 types of resultants. The first one is to be experienced in this very life. And then the second one is in the next life, immediately in the next life. And if they don't bear fruit in this very life or in the next life, then they become defunct. Cannot give fruits anymore. It's just like in this lifetime, you might become a very accomplished pianist or something. At the end of this life, you are reborn in the next life, it's gone, you know. But the seeds are sown. Somehow, in your next life, if you come across a piano again, you might be able to pick it up and play without being taught. You know, like some of these child prodigies, right? Whatever you do is not in vain. Some vestiges of it is still left in what we call the potential karmic field. Okay, so karma in the next life and karma that follows you until you attain Nibbana. That's a long time. So anytime anything good or bad can occur, depending on causes and conditions. Okay, the succession of karma should be known. What is the succession of karma? Karma Nirodha. What's the cause of karma? Contact, isn't it? So what is the succession of karma? Contact lah. No contact, no karma. It's only because you contact with something through your 6 senses, that's why there's karma, you react to it. If there's no contact, there's no karma. Right? But the thing is, how to get there? Alright, so that's why the last one says, what is the path of practice for the cessation of karma? That one is also very simple. All of you know, right? It's the Noble Eightfold Path. So if you follow the Noble Eightfold Path, it will eventually lead to the cessation of contact, lead to the cessation of karma. Okay, but then the other sutta that I talked about, new and old karma, remember? That one comes from Sanghita Nikaya. He says here, monks, I will teach you new and old karma, the cessation of karma, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of karma. So I've already told you what is old karma, right? All the six sense organs are old karma, and new karma is the intention involved in your thoughts, speech, and action. The cessation of karma in this sutta is defined by the Buddha as whoever touches the release that comes from the cessation of bodily karma, verbal karma, and mental karma. This is called the cessation of karma. Which means to say that the release here refers to liberation. Whoever has attained liberation through the cessation of karma, through the body, speech, and mind, that is actually the cessation of karma. Which is actually similar to the answer that cessation of contact is a cessation of karma. It's similar, it's just put in another way. And the path leading to the cessation of karma is, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path. So, in conclusion, I would like to say that karma is a very complicated subject. Although it can be very useful at times when we exhaust all other forms of reasoning to understand a particular situation, we can say that it's due to karma. But one should also not be fatalistic, because whatever circumstances that present themselves, we should also try our level best to overcome it through our resources and through our own creativity. And finally, after having done to the best of our ability and nothing works, then at least we can safely say, that's my karma. Without being fatalistic. Okay, I'm ending the talk right now. So, any questions?
Pante, what is actually consciousness, vijnana? Is it closely equated to perception or something else?
Okay, good question. The problem is in English language, when people translate the Pali words, we use certain English terms, and to people who are not familiar with Buddhist terminology, they have different understandings. For example, the word consciousness, the word awareness, in English language, they are like interchangeable, very vague what it really means. Now let's look at the Pali word. The Pali word for consciousness is vijnana. And the Pali word for mind is mano. Just now we talked about mind organ. We have our five sense organs, which are very obvious. We have eye, ear, and so forth. But what is a mind organ? Is it something physical or is it mental? Okay, that's also another question. Then the vijnana, or the consciousness, is tagged to our different senses. So we have chakku vijnana, which is eye consciousness. We have sota vijnana, which is ear consciousness, and so forth. And then kaya vijnana, which is body consciousness. And then we have mano vijnana, which is mind consciousness. Okay, now let me analyze the word vijnana. Vijnana starts with the prefix vi and jnana. Alright, jnana here actually means knowing. Alright, knowing. So, you see, the word knowing also is a very, very vague word. It's a whole range of things, from just bare awareness or bare consciousness of something to understanding something. We use the word know. So, vi janati ti vijnanam. Vi janati. It's a verb. Vijnana is a noun. Janati means simply to know, to be aware of. And vi means in a special way. Alright? So, chakku vijnana is knowing in a special way through the eye. What does that mean? That means that the eye can only perceive or be aware or be conscious of colors. Right or not? That's why it's very specific. It's special awareness of just colors. Sota vijnana, the ear consciousness can only be aware of sounds. Then gahana vijnana, the nose consciousness can only be aware or be conscious of smells. So each of these senses have their own special field of awareness. The eye consciousness can only be aware of colors, cannot be aware of sounds or tastes or smells or physical sensations. And similarly for all the other organs, each of them only has their own object. So that's why it's V, special knowing of a particular object. Then we come to Manovijnana. Manovijnana is the mind consciousness. Then mind consciousness is also very special, because the mind consciousness is so special that it knows all the five sense objects as well as other things. Okay? So that is Vijnana. Now when you look at Vijnana in the sense of the five aggregates, you don't know five aggregates? You have Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. Rupa is form, Vedana is feeling, Sanya is perception, Sankara is volitional formations, and Vijnana is consciousness. Of these five aggregates, the four, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness, they occur simultaneously, at the same time. Although we have different words for them, for different aspects of them, they occur simultaneously at the same time. And this I can liken to a corporate body, an organization, or a company. In a company, you have a board of directors, different departments. You have accounting department, admin department, you have the HR department, you have the sales department, right? And all of these constitute a company. A company is a combination of all these departments. They work together. In the same way, the citta is composed of all these things. Citta composed of Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, and Vijnana. So, feelings, just feel nice, not nice, neutral. That is the job of feelings. That is the feelings department. Then Sanya can only recognize this, recognize that. And Sankhara is anything that has a volition in your mind. Want to do this, want to do that, want to remember this, right? That is Sankhara. Vijnana's job is just to be barely aware. Vijnana is just bare consciousness, bare awareness, knowing that there is sound, knowing that there is light, there is color. But as I said, all of them work together. They don't work separately. It's when we talk about them that we separate them. When they occur at the same time, then Vijnana knows an object. Sanya recognizes it. And then Vedana feels it, nice or not nice. And then Sankhara is the one that intends what to do. So the job of Vijnana is very, very simple. Not complex at all. It's not like Sanya or like Sankhara. Vijnana is just know only, a sense of consciousness that something is there. Bare awareness. Bare consciousness. Hope that answers your question. Okay?
You said karma is intention. So that implies there is a certain amount of conscious, but how intentional is intention? Say, for example, today I make a vow that I will not get angry absolutely. But then if someone is rude to me, immediately I retort with anger, even though I have no intention at all to reply with anger. So whose intention is it? Whose karma is it?
Okay, good question. If there's intention, does that mean that there's free will? What is free? You don't get a free lunch. No free one. All intentions, all volitions are product of causes and conditions. The way you want to intend to do something is also a product of conditioning. Why not? Why do you decide that you don't want to be angry? Because you read somewhere or somebody advised you or something, then this is the thing that feeds into your mind and produces this intention, the one to get angry. Right? But you must understand anatta. This is not yours, you know. The intention is not yours. It arose because of these various causes and conditions. Then, because it's not yours, it would not necessarily listen to you. So when you meet with somebody and then it provokes you, And because your causes and conditions for following the intention is not there, you get angry. And then you retort back at the person, you say angry words. Okay, so that is also intention, you know. That is the intention to want to say things back at that person. But that intention also, due to causes and conditions, the way you were brought up, your perception of what this person is like, and he's like that all the time, it's like that one, I cannot change one, that's why you get angry at him. So it's nothing is free one, it's all causes and conditions. It's just which cause and condition is more predominant at that particular point of time.
Pante, morning. I had wandering minds, so I had participated in retreat before, so I feel good. But in daily life, how should I continue to cultivate? My question is it sitting meditation every day, like morning or before sleep, it can help to maintain, or how is it the way to prevent less wandering minds?
How is that related to karma? Okay, let me answer that in terms of karma. Actually, to have a wandering mind, it's also a karma in the sense that the mind that wanders off, and how you regard that mind or how you react to that wandering mind will create the karma in you. Okay, what is the karma? If you don't like the wandering mind, you say, how come I want to meditate and yet this wandering mind comes to disturb me? It's the bad karma of wrong view, because there's no I in the first place. The wandering mind doesn't belong to you. Because you have this wrong view that the mind belongs to you, that you want to control it. The reason why the Buddha says it's anatta is because you cannot control. So our purpose of practicing Vipassana meditation is to understand this, that there is no one in control, that all these come about because of causes and conditions. As long as you don't get caught up in the thoughts, in the wandering thoughts, that's okay. If you get caught up in them, then you are creating more karma in any intentions that are involved in it. Now, your suggestion that having formal sittings at once or twice a day is also good. That will also help to stabilize your mind, make it more composed. But what is even more important, I would say, is to have continuous mindfulness throughout the whole day, every time coming back to watch your mind. Even if the mind is wandering, if you're aware that you're wandering, that point of time, you are mindful. And if you can look at that wandering mind as not me, not mine, not myself, I don't want the wandering mind, it came by itself. You see, there's right view. And another practical way of anchoring your mind is to try to come back to your five senses. To make it a habit to come back to your five senses, see, hear, smell, taste, and feel with the body, particularly your body. But seeing can be very distracting because automatically when we see something, the mind will start to think already. So maybe it's easier, less distracting to just be aware of your bodily sensations, whatever you are doing. So we are doing a lot of things all the time. Right now also you are listening to me. Are you aware of your body? Can you be aware of your body? You are sitting on the cushion, your back is erect, your clothes are touching your skin. You know, your feet are touching the floor. Can't you be aware of that? Can? So this is something like an anchor, you know. You bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. Whatever you're doing, make it a habit. And then the moment your mind runs off and is not aware of what's happening to your five senses, it means that you can catch it really. You know, oh, it's run off already. When you know that it has run off, then you can have a time to step back and find out whether it's worth pursuing or not. If it's not worth pursuing, not productive thought, just let it go. And look at it, it's not me, not mine, it came by itself. Now when you do that regularly, you can see more and more often that actually it's not yours. It came about because of a certain sense stimulus. You saw something, it reminded you of something, and that triggered off a whole train of thoughts about something of the past.
So I'm thinking maybe because I have like greed, so during morning time, I start to think what I want to do today. Then the thoughts multiply.
So that's why I'm saying, if you are able to step back and watch your thoughts as they arise, you'll be able to catch the intentions, right? And once you're able to catch the intentions, then you will be able to distinguish whether it is worth doing or not. Is it beneficial? Yeah? Is it appropriate? Is it relevant to me? Is it realistic? You watch it that way. And then if it's not, it's not beneficial, not appropriate, not relevant to me, not realistic, drop it. Then another intention comes up. And another one comes up and you look at it, well, it's beneficial, appropriate, realistic, and relevant to me, then go ahead and pursue that thought. If not, drop it. In that way, we can be more productive, right? So unproductive thoughts, we drop. Productive thoughts, we pursue. Okay, hope that helps.